Viola Williams, Reel 12.
I've got something the other day, so before we go on to career, I wonder if you'd like this bit. While I was with the LCC immediately after the war in 1946, accommodation in London was almost impossible to find, and I finally got a bed sit in Brixton. With one gas ring, the loo down the passage, dim or purposeful, and no washing accommodation at all, except a basin and a bowl in the room. The lighting was gas. It was that ghastly winter that was so cold. I mean, it really was absolutely impossible. The only thing I could do then was to cook it up in masses of clothes and work, which is what I did. But on Saturday afternoons, it was always Saturday afternoons, we went to Camberwell, where there was a public bath, and they were cubicles with open tops, and you could have as much water as you liked, and very hot water, which was a bit of a change from the 2 inches that they had been allowed. And it was an absolute education, because most women came in pairs, and they each had a cubicle, and they then shouted to each other. And what I learned about life in London during those baths on Saturday afternoon, which was just no odds to anybody.
Can you think of an example?
Utterly and completely personal things they were. Things like, well, you see, when I was having my baby, and with stuff like that, and I can't remember offhand, but at the time, I remember mine got warm for the first time for the week, and you laughed, and it was good. And the other thing that I got while I was with the LCC was the building, of course, was just by Waterloo Station. And if you went underneath the arches, and it really was underneath the arches, it was really dank, it still is very dank underneath. But on the other side of the railway was Marsh Lane. And Marsh Lane was a row of little tiny artisan shops and little groceries and little butchers and little this, little that. And of course we were still on rations, we still had our ration books. And I checked in with a grocer there, and it was fascinating, because the grocer was a nice man, and it finished up with him working it out that the women who came in there for their rations wanted tinned fruit and tinned vegetables and anything that they could have tinned. Well, I didn't want tinned, but I did want butter. And I did want cheese. And so the grocer worked it out that I handed in my fruit tinned coupons, and they handed in their butter and cheese coupons, and we switched. And it worked out very well. I never met any of the women that I swapped with, but he knew all about it. And it was a because I could always get my vegetables and possibly eggs, you see, from home if I went home for the weekend. But I still remember that those swappings of coupons. Okay.
So now Korea. Did you go to Korea immediately after Malaya?
No, I went back to the WI, and I did another year with the WI at National, which... again, was it quite interesting, because we had the Royal Show at Nottingham that year, and the National asked me if I would put on an exhibit, and I put on an exhibit of sugar, sugar through the ages, sugar as it is used nowadays, sugar in wine. It was a big exhibit, and the pièce de résistance was going to be a galleon in icing, and I played with this night, and finally I took it with me the night before we went, and I put it up the next day, and I took one look at it, and I thought, no, that is not good enough. So we ate it for tea and I put something else up instead. I could do it now because I've got the technique now, but I didn't have the technique then, and it just wasn't good enough for the sort of showpiece. But luckily I had a whole lot of glass globes that I got from the chemist, those wonderful things that used to be filled with red liquids and blue liquids and so on. And I did it all with different coloured sugar liquids as appears to, and they looked very nice. I was quite pleased with it.
This would be the period coming out of austerity.
55.
Yes, things were getting better
then.
Yes. I think I need to take you on to Korea. Right. You know, it's these sort of areas of conflict which we're mainly interested in. Why was it that you went to, and how was it that you went to Korea?
Well, I just about come to the end of what I could give the National. The World YWCA in Geneva had been looking for somebody to go to Korea. The Korean War had just about finished. The Canadian YWCA had got an interest there and had set up a training school for teenage orphans. It sent out a Canadian to look after it. And the Canadian had only been there about 3 weeks when she caught some ghastly bug, which put her out of work for about 6 months. And so the worldwide was looking for somewhere else. They asked the UN, the FAO people, and they recommended me after malaria. And the worldwide wrote to me and said, would I like to go out to Korea? My father just absolutely knew his top. He said, you can't possibly go out there. It's the most ghastly country. You can't possibly go out there. And anyway, I said, yes, I was interested. And they had a meeting in London. And so I went up to the London meeting and met the boss, not the boss, but one of the bosses in Geneva, who came over to the London meeting. And I took her out into the garden and I said, look, I think I ought to explain that I don't know much about the YWCA. I suppose I go to church occasionally, but I'm not a practicing Christian, and if that's what you want, I'm afraid that's it. And Janet Thompson, who ultimately became a great friend of mine, said, oh, no, that's perfectly right. We've got plenty of Christians. What we want at the moment is a farmer. They'd also got the two Koreans, the boss of the Koreans was there, and the two Canadians were at the meeting. So I went in and saw them, and we came to an agreement. And I went on to the Canadian staff that was employed. It was all very peculiar, they were employed by the worldwide. And I gave notice to the National and went. And it was even quite an interesting trip out, because I went, they wanted me to get some idea of the YWCA en route. So I went to Lebanon, I went to Jerusalem, where I was made a member of the YWCA. I feel very proud that I was made a member in Jerusalem. And then I went on to Japan, and I had 2 or 3 days in Japan, and then I went up to Korea, and I arrived just before Christmas. And I stayed in...
What year would that have been?
55.
So it was pretty soon after the armistice,
yes,
2 years.
Yes, things were still in a terrible mess. And so I stayed there for over Christmas. And my horror, we celebrated it in Coca-Cola. And I asked, there was an American working there. I said, do we always celebrate Christmas in Coca-Cola? She said, oh yes, this is very, very anti everything. So one of the first things I did when I set up was to start making some homemade wine. It was impossible to live on Coca-Cola out there. Anyway, we went down to have a look at the training centre, which was about 300 miles away.
From Seoul, was that?
Yes, and we were in Seoul, and then the training centre was just outside Busan, in a place called Tongnae. And we went down, we stayed the night there. Did we stay the night? Yes, we did. And the woman in charge of the thing took one look at me, and departed that night, which rather sort of shook everybody. I went back to Seoul and spent Christmas there, and then in the new year I went down, and it was the most appalling mess. It was absolutely filthy. They got something like 45 teenage girls there. There was a very good building that was the main building, which was the Australian Presbyterian Mission had given it to us, but the kids all lived in Korean-style housing. We hadn't got a house mother, and we were catching the first thing I did was clean out the whole of the where the kids were living. I mean, everything came out, and we spent a whole week cleaning up, much to everybody's astonishment. But it was necessary, and we were catching 8 rats a day. They were tame. They used to sit on the rafters and clean their whiskers and say hello to us. That got me that one thing or another. But gradually it began to take shape. The kids were teenage orphan girls, because the Korea, there were lots of, Korea was just full of orphanages. Every available organisation had cashed in on all the on orphanages, and for many of them it was a question of cashing in. But the snag was that when the children became 14, they were chucked out, whether they were boys or girls, they were chucked out of the orphanage. Well, if it was a boy, it was all white. I mean, you just didn't choose what was coming up. But if it was a girl, there was only one profession. And so the YWCA was trying to, we ultimately finished with 60 girls. And what we were trying to do was to give them either some kind of education that would, or training that would enable them to get a job, or to my utter astonishment, after I'd been there about 4 or 5 months, the local parson came up, the local Korean parson came up, and after the usual politenesses, he looked at me and he said, I've got a very nice young man, what have you got? And I said, what a clue he's talking about. And then it transpired that, of course, in Korea in those days, the boys and the girls, they didn't really meet. If they couldn't even go to the cinema together. They sat in different sections in church, and their marriages were arranged by their parents. Well, with orphans with no parents were at a disadvantage. So the parson was looking after the YMCA young men, and I was looking after the YWCA young men. And so in due course, I worked out that we'd got somebody who was just about ready. And so we had we had an engagement party in the local Chinese restaurant, which was the only place you could possibly go to. And the young man came in with the parson and a supporter, and we got our girl into Korean clothes for the occasion. All our kids were in clothes mostly from New Zealand, because New Zealand was sending us masses of relief clothes. We got her into Korean clothes for the occasion. And the house mother, I got a good house mother by then, and we went in, and our girl took one very quick look at the young man, and then put her eyes down and her hands folded, and she neither said nor ate nor did anything for the rest of the meal, because if she'd done anything like that, she would have been a very fast young woman and the young man might not have wanted her. But it all passed off all right, and about 2 months later we had the wedding, and we had it up in our hall. We got quite a decent hall, and two of the farmer's little girls dressed up in Korean clothes, which were absolutely exquisite. All beautiful colours and stripes, and little dresses. They look absolutely lovely. And we put sheets all down the centre of the hall. We cut up some sheets to make her a white dress for the occasion, because that was all we got to do a white dress. And the young man and the parson arrived, and they stood at the end of the hall, and the little maidens came up, scattering little pieces of coloured paper all on the white sheets. And ultimately, supported by housemother, our girl came in with her eyes cast down, and it took her 20 minutes to cover about 14 feet of ground. Because if she'd gone any faster, she was a very fast young woman, and the young man could still discard her. But the marriage took place, and almost to the day she produced a small boy, and she brought the kid to show us, and she was so proud and she was so happy. You see, the girls there, with not knowing their men before they went in with very little sort of thought of what was going to happen, so that anything that happened that was good was a bonus. And they were, we married off a lot of our girls, and they all appeared to make very happy marriages. But the whole situation out there really was pretty grim.
Yes, that would be very interesting, you know, if you could give a picture of the post-war situation.
Well,
perhaps in Seoul, first of all, would that be?
Seoul, I didn't see much of, because I only went up there for meetings. It was a nice city. It was beginning to find its feet again. Things were beginning to take shape there, much more there than they were down with us, because we had something like 250,000 refugees on the hills around our area, living in packing cases, petrol tins, cardboard boxes, bits of canvas, which was bad enough in the winter when it was cold, but in the summer, when in July and August it rained solidly, the rain just came down the hillside and it just went straight through all the accommodation. And it really was pretty grim. I was out there 3 years, and during that time we managed to most of them, we managed to sort of, at least the authorities managed to get back into their villages, or but some of them who come from North Korea, so didn't get back at all. But most of them, we still had a few left for the time I went, but most of them have gone. But our kids, when you find a child of 14, 15 walking up the path, and she would have a blouse and a skirt and a pair of shoes. She wouldn't have anything else in the world, neither parents, nor property, nor nothing. And she'd arrive and she'd say, "I've come. Can you take me in?" And we took her in. And for the first week after she came, she never, at the end of any meal, she always wrapped something up in a piece of rag and hid it somewhere, in case she never got anything more to eat. It really was pretty grim. And the other thing that that we found, which in some ways was funny, but it was not altogether, was that most of the girls who came to us, they've had 4 or 5 years of war or malnutrition or whatever. And so instead of making decent bone structure, they more or less stayed the same sort of size. And when they came to us, when we could give them one meat meal a week, we were desperately poor. We could only manage one meat meal a week, but even with that, and with good supplies of vegetables and rice, they did begin to put on a lot of weight. But because they hadn't got the bone structure, they didn't go up. They went out. And we finished up with almost square children, which had its drawbacks, because, as I said, we got our clothes mostly from New Zealand and Australia, and the teenagers there were delighted to send them to the teenagers in Korea. But of course, a teenage there was a sylph-like thing, and ours were not. So we usually had to put 2 dresses together to make one decent dress to cover our kids with. But we took what the general situation was still pretty grim. There were a lot of peace about, there was still a lot of army about, and of course we had an enormous American camp quite close to us, Pioneer, and without that, I don't know that we should have survived. After all the invasion of Salisbury Plain, where I lived during the war, an American soldier, as far as I was concerned, was anathema. But that Korean camp, they could not have been nice. They were absolutely wonderful. They helped us as an orphanage. They helped me as an individual, and they helped the community wherever they could. They were wonderful. And my opinion of Americans went up about 95% as a result of that army camp. I was lucky because, you see, I was YWCA, which was neutral. I wasn't government. I wasn't local council. I wasn't a church. Our institution was neutral, and therefore we were able to be quite useful to the other organisations that were out there. For instance, we had there was a Swedish hospital who were doing free work for anybody who wanted. That was a very good hospital. And when they went, the Germans took over. I'm not sure whether it was the Germans first and the Swedes afterwards, but they did it on very much the same lines. And they would take our children. If our kids were seen sick, I had a general sort of prescription for them, which was crushed aspirin, crushed sugar, and crushed veg lax tablets, and washed down with water. And if that didn't have any effect, I'd take them down to a local Korean doctor, who invariably gave them an injection, which I strongly suspect was always water. And if that didn't work, then I'd take them down to the Swedish hospital or German hospital, who would give them a thorough turn. They all had to be wormed anyway every 6 months. I mean, that was to be, we all got wormed every 6 months. Everything yet was full of worms. But all the vegetables were grown on human manure, you see. So, I mean, it was just automatic that you went worms all the time. The boss of the German hospital, I got on with him terribly well, and occasionally he would, I'd got stairs, and I'd hear coughing up the stairs, and he'd come in and he'd say, "I have come," and I got a good sort of lounge bed, and he would lay down on the lounge bed, and about 2 hours later he'd wake up and say, "I must go." But that was the kind of thing that did a tremendous amount of good in the neighbourhood. The army chaplain, who was a very very harassed gentleman with all the army sort of things to deal with and all the complications of babies and another all over the place, he would come, and he would come for a whole afternoon and he'd just lie down, if he needed a meal, I gave him a meal. If he didn't, well, he just stayed there and got himself together again and went back to the camp. But we found that was very useful because a lot of the people who were working there, especially if they hadn't done overseas stuff before, got terribly stressed by the conditions. I had an American come over to stay with me for 2 or 3 days. And she just couldn't take it. She said, "Father, how do you stand all this condition, this dirt, this poverty, this misery?" But you see, when you're dealing with that sort of thing, it's like being a hospital nurse. You cannot become involved. You can have as much sympathy, you can do as much as you possibly can to relieve the conditions, but you cannot become emotionally involved, because if you do, you're sunk. And she just couldn't take it. It really was it really was pretty grim. But there were a lot of very funny things about it. I was a foreigner. Therefore, I was fair game for anybody in the neighbourhood. And the first people who took advantage of it were the fire brigade. And they came up and said that they wanted to see all our fire precautions. And I showed them all the buckets of sand that we got, all buckets of soil that we got all over the place. It's no good doing anything with water, because the fact it wasn't any water. We had a well, but it was a dubious well, and the Americans once analysed it, and after that we never thought about it anymore, because it was so full of every conceivable bug. But the fire brigade went through it all, and we gave them coffee and one thing and another. And then they said, well, we would have to have a lot more equipment if we were really going to be safe. Lot more equipment. So I said, okay, well, where do we get the equipment? Oh, you buy that from us, they said. So we went on talking for a little while, and I said something about the London Blitz. And the man in charge perked his ears up and said, were you in the London Blitz? So I said, on and off, yes. He said, oh, well, in that case, you know all about fires, we won't bother you anymore. And that was the end of that one. He just disappeared. The next people who came up were the telephone people who said they were, but they were quickly disposed of us. We had no telephone, so there was no problem with them. Then the electricity people came up, and they said they'd be able to, but as there was no electricity, we disposed of them too. The ultimate electricity was there was a local school who was below us, and they had about 2,000 kids in the school. Yes, this was in a village, but you see, everybody who could take orphans had got orphans, and there were about 2,000 children. It was a primary school. They had three sessions a day, a morning session, an afternoon, and an evening session. And the same teachers took all three sessions. But the headmaster and I got on very well together, and we decided that we were going to get some electricity up between us. We thought we could manage the cost of it. So we finally got a line up from Poussin, I think it was, which was quite some way. It's quite costly getting it. But he got a branch line, and I got a branch line, and it was wonderful, because instead of using paraffin for everything, one could at last begin to have a proper fridge instead of a paraffin fridge, and proper lighting instead of Aladdin's, and proper cooking instead of some antique paraffin stove. But the first time the bill came in, the headmaster came rushing up to me and he said, have you had your electricity bill? And I said, yes, and it's absolutely horrendous. He said, well, mine is just beyond all belief. And they were absolutely ghastly, the bills. And so we went into this in great detail, and we discovered that practically every house in the village had tapped in on our line. And we were paying for the whole, between us, we were paying for the whole village to have electricity.
This schoolmaster, would he have been Korean?
Oh,
yes, most of the staff were they?
Yes, I was the only Westerner. My nearest English-speaking neighbours was the Australian Presbyterian Hospital, which was in Busan, and I stayed with one of them last year in Australia, and we've kept up ever since because we got on very well. They weren't being paid for any of the work. The two Koreans and the two English in charge were, the Australians in charge were, but the people who came as patients didn't have to pay. We had a lot of hospitals there. Including one which shook me absolutely rigid,